The story that we've just heard, both from Ezra and Nehemiah's account and also from the Gospel of John, is a case study, really, in crossing the social, political, and religious boundaries. And in Jesus, what we see is a model of a way to break the cycle that we have perpetuated as human beings on one another since we left the garden, the cycle of shame and violence between peoples of differing perspectives, differing cultures, and differing traditions. Violence, in most every case, proceeds from a sense of shame, with the perpetrators of violence lashing out at whatever or whoever they're projecting their shame onto. And why do they do this? Because they've been raised to have shame. And this, in turn, leads to a spiraling of violence, as those who are ashamed of being bullied become the bullies, and the abused become the abusers, and the cycle of shame and violence continues. Or even worse, it begins to escalate. That cycle of shame and violence doesn't have to continue, however. Jesus showed us a way to break out of this cycle, and this Sunday's gospel lesson is a case in point. Jesus is traveling through Samaria, a land populated by Samaritans, whom Judeans despised. Now, it wasn't always this way. They, after all, were all the 12 tribes that made up Israel. All of these, the Samaritans and the Judeans, were all brothers and sisters. But in 586 BCE, the king of Babylon conquered Israel, destroyed the temple that Solomon had built, and enslaved the political and the religious leadership of Jerusalem and took them off into exile. The phrase, "time heals all wounds," did not apply to Israel. Like most people, the Judeans were looking for a reason, for someone to blame long after their exile had ended, trying to make sense of why God would have allowed this to happen to several generations, right, that had not caused the sins that led them into exile in the first place. Why had we been in exile for so long, God, if we've not done anything wrong? Something must be wrong. And the Judeans found a convenient scapegoat, and it was the northern tribes of Israel that they blamed for the exile. After all, there is no hate like brotherly hate. Think Cain and Abel. The charge leveled against them was that their foreign wives had led them astray from God's ways, as had happened to Solomon, so Ezra and Nehemiah said. Never mind that the prophets of the same period, prophet Jeremiah, prophet Isaiah, prophet Ezekiel, prophet Micah, said, no, the reason that you're going into exile is for failing to grant justice to the orphans, to the widows, and to the foreigners in the midst of you. It's because you have not treated people with the equity that God expects out of you. That's why you're going into exile. So Judean leaders, like Ezra and Nehemiah, demanded that all such men, immediately upon returning from the exile, when they came back to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem and the city, were to immediately divorce their wives, passing along the experience of humiliation, abandonment, and exile once again. Not too surprisingly, most of the Samaritan women and men said, no way, we're not doing this, which led to this humiliating treatment by the leaders in Judea of their brothers and sisters to the north. In Nehemiah's own words, I contended with them, and cursed them, and I beat some of them, and I pulled out their hair, and I made them take an oath in the name of God. Thus I cleansed them from everything foreign. And so began the hatred between Judeans and Samaritans that was centuries old now by the time that Jesus came to Jacob's well on that high day of noon and was approached by a Samaritan woman. It was noon. That tells us everything we need to know about this situation. It's in the heat of the high day sun, a time when most women would be inside where it's cool. Not a time you'd want to be lugging around a heavy jar on your head or shoulders. The other women went to the well early in the morning when the work wouldn't be quite so hard because the sun wouldn't be so high up and it wouldn't be so hot. And the drudgery of hauling water would be eased by the fellowship shared with other women who'd gathered around the well, where they'd talk, gossip. But this woman was one of the people the other women loved to talk about. And the fact that she showed up at noon was a sure sign that she was not welcome in their morning social hour. And yet, as oppressive as that noonday sun was beating down on her, it didn't burn like the stares of the others in the village for the rest of the day. And so she was content to do this. So she goes to the well when she's sure that nobody's going to be there, when she's going to be alone. But she isn't, is she? Jesus is there, and he speaks to her, which is something that men only did if they were the husband of the woman they were talking to in public, but more likely if it was a man who was not married to the woman and was speaking to her in public, then it was because he was propositioning her. So having been used and discarded by so many men from the village, she replies to Jesus that she has no one right now that's her husband. And Jesus agrees with her, but not in the way that she is being used to being talked to. Jesus says, "You are right, for you have had five husbands, more than Elizabeth Taylor." No, he doesn't say that. Which is, if you were to put into our context, would be like Jesus saying, "You are right, man. You are right, woman. You have had all of these different men in your life, and you've been with five of them, but none of them who were married to you truly loved you." This poor woman has had her dignity taken from her by so many men that the intimacy of this conversation that she's having now with this man, Jesus, throws her off balance. She's not sure what to do because he's not propositioning her, but he is exposing her to some truths of her own life. How does he know this? So she tries to change the subject back to what's comfortable. Let's talk about religion. Let's talk about the difference between Jews and Samaritans. You can hardly blame her for trying to distract him. If he knows about all of her husbands, there is no telling what else he knows about her. And she decided right here and then that she'd rather not find out. "I don't know what else he's got on me, man." But it doesn't work out like that. So when she steps back away from Jesus, what does he do? Jesus steps toward her. When she steps out of the light, he steps into it and brings the light back onto her. He will not let this woman retreat. If she is determined to show less of herself to him, then he is determined to show more of who he is to her. And she says, "I know that the Messiah is coming." And he says, "I am he." Whoa. I mean, seriously, whoa. This is utterly amazing. It's the very first time in any of the Gospels where Jesus has literally come out himself and said to another human, such as this Samaritan woman, "I am the Messiah." He asks Peter who people say he is, but he doesn't come out and tell Peter directly. He says, "You've answered correctly." And of course, we know Peter really didn't. But this Samaritan woman, this outsider, this stranger to everything that he's known for, I mean, in terms of being a Jew from Judea, he puts that aside and accepts her by talking to her in this manner. It's a full moment of disclosure in which this ultimate outsider, the Samaritan woman, meets the ultimate insider, the Son of God. Standing face to face with one another with no pretense about who they are, both stand fully lit at high noon for one bright moment in time, while all the taboos, while all of the prejudices, while all of the history between them and animosity that separates them is exposed in the light of day and evaporates like water mist in the highlight of the noon sun. When Jesus confirms her identity as a woman who has been married five times, he is confirming a truth about this woman, but by confirming this truth, he is also setting her free. Why has she been married five times, you might be asking yourselves? It's because she can't produce heirs. Think Henry VIII. That's why this woman has been discarded five different times. And the acknowledgement of this truth by Jesus to her is enough to show her that Jesus, the Son of God, supports her, is with her, stands by her, knows exactly what she's going through. The Messiah is the one in whose presence you know who you really are. You're seeing, finally, both the good and the bad of it all, the all of it, the hope of it, all of it. The Messiah is the one who shows you who you are by showing you who he is. Someone willing to cross over boundaries that have been falsely drawn by us. Somebody willing to break rules and laws all the time, especially if they get in the way of God and people, always putting humans before the law. Drops all disguises, speaking to you like someone you have known all of your life, with an intimacy that only somebody who has been with you all your life would know. Such is the intimacy of God. And what happens is that she goes back now into her village in the height of the day, the village where she has been shunned. And she says joyfully, man, this is what she does. She goes back in with enthusiasm. And she says, come and see a man who told me everything that I have ever done. I want you to meet this guy because he's amazing. Now, what transformed this woman could transform all of us. And it could transform our country. It could transform our world. And these issues that we face today, such as travel bans, are nothing new. They date back to the times of Ezra and Nehemiah, man. These issues that we keep dealing with throughout history are issues that remind us that the living Word of God speaks today just as it did back then. And the issues haven't changed. We still deal with prejudice. We still deal with boundaries falsely drawn. We still deal with all the same things. Why? Because we live in a fallen state. And we need to admit it, to get honest about it. And once we do, we're free. Once we're due, we're free. You see, the woman at the well was despised by her own village. And this northern village, in turn, was despised by the southern village in Judea, of Jerusalem, who were the brothers and the sisters, by the way, of the Samaritans, whose ancestors had been humiliated by the Assyrians and the Babylonians. And you can see this cycle of violence now going way back. And from generation to generation, humiliation, resentment, and violence were passed down by people who were keeping score so that they could even it. And they never did. To this day, we have never evened the score. To this day, we still fight in the Middle East the way we did 2,000 years ago. What has changed? Nothing. And yet the Messiah is here from generation to generation. Jesus is trying to show us how to break out of this cycle of shame and violence, folks. That's what these stories are about. They're designed to show us how to live differently than the way society says we should live or the way the principalities and powers tell us we should live. The only question really is, are we willing to listen to him or are we going to keep listening to fake news? Amen.